I'm out and about. This is me on the field, me out in the field, me literally in the field. Obviously doing a bit of cutting down. There's a big swoosh of recently mowed lawn in the field. Once burnt a wheelchair. We found a wheelchair in a dumpster, set fire to it, and he set half the field ablaze. It's only about 13. We had to run back and forth to my house, which is just up the hill, frantically getting buckets of water, pretending that we were having a frantic, urgent water fight, where we were at risk of death. My mum's like, why are you so sweaty? Why are you so frantic? What's wrong, boys? We're like, no, it's fine. Just funny water fights. Mum, funny water fights. Now, quickly, quickly. What time is it? Oh, yeah, 11. Yeah, so sometimes, I took Alan down here the other day. He prefers to go with his mum. Mum throws the ball for him, whereas I'm quite austere. Quick walk. No frivolity, no frippery, no throwing balls about. We're grown up men. Done and dog. And yeah, he's kind of like a low level of depressed every time he comes out of me. It's good to be out of the house, but he's not really getting in touch with nature, like Ralph Waldo Emerson, the transcendentalist. I read a book about his essays and transcriptions of his lectures, and he's bang on about the sort of transcendent qualities of nature, and its potential to sort of gild a person's soul, something like that. This is the kind of bollocks it comes out. No, it's not actually bollocks, it's quite beautiful poetic language. I'm capable of that kind of wanky poesy every now and again. Nearly home. Been walking for an hour and a half. Holding the ship for that entire time. In, out, teeter tottering on my sphincter. Sort of tease it out so it thinks it's about to slide out, but slurp it back up. Boom. Episode 2. And that was some of me chitter-chattering outdoors. Thought it'd add a bit of texture, but it's pretty pointless, really. Just going on about my feces, as is my wont. I spoke about Ralph Waldo Emerson there as well. I read a bit of Ralph Waldo Emerson. I've got the essential writings of Ralph Waldo Emerson, and there's a quote on the front here which is from Walt Whitman. It says, I was simmering. Emerson brought me to a boil. I think that means he wanked him off. I think that's what that means. I think Emerson wanked off Walt Whitman. I mean, that's unsubstantiated, so you can't hold me to that. You know, you want to try and sue me, Whitman? You ain't going to get nowhere near me, boy. I just clarified it's unsubstantiated, but that sounds pretty fucking wanky offy to me. Bring you to a boil. Everyone knows what that means. But this is some of Ralph Waldo Emerson, so one of the transcendentalists. To go into solitude, a man needs to retire as much from his chamber as from society. It means leave his bedroom. I am not solitary whilst I read and write, though nobody is with me. But if a man would be alone, let him look at the stars. The rays that come from those heavenly worlds will separate between him and what he touches. One might think the atmosphere was made transparent with this design to give man in heavenly bodies the perpetual presence of the sublime. Seen in the streets of cities, how great they are! If the stars should appear one night in a thousand years, how would men believe and adore and preserve for many generations the remembrance of the city of God, which had been shown? But every night come out these envoys of beauty, envoys in it, and light the universe with their admonishing smile. When we speak of nature in this manner, we have a distinct but most poetical sense of the mind. We mean the integrity of impression made by manifold natural objects. It is this which distinguishes the stick of timber of the woodcutter from the tree of the poet. The charming landscape which I saw this morning is indubitably made up of some 20 or 30 farms. Miller owns this field, Locke that, and Manning the woodland beyond, but none of them own the landscape. They probably do in Britain. I mean, isn't it? There's that book about the English countryside where I think like a third of the land in Britain is owned by sort of the landed gentry or the line of succession within the royal family. It's owned by royals, basically, a third of our land. But none of them own the landscape. There is a property in the horizon which no man has, but he's whose eyes can integrate all the parts, that is the poet. This is the best part of these men's farms. Yet to this, their warranty deeds give no title. I mean, just say that you've been in out and about in the woods, that you prodded a froth of tadpoles with a Bic biro, put a conker in your mouth. I've actually wrote a little bit about nature. I'm not a nature writer by habit. That is not. I know it's not saying comfortable. I don't know the names of flowers. Like when I read people who talk about the gardenias, I don't know what a gardenia to me is. It like I imagine it like a basket flower. Is that right? It's kind of droops, one of those ones that droops down. But I can't say that. So it might be breach of contract. Something I have been writing. I'm going to read a little bit for you now. And it is about the sanctity and preservation of all living things was instilled in me from a young age. Any bugs or insects removed from the dirt had to be put back where I found them. Keep them with their mummies and daddies, Mum would say. Keep them with their mummies and daddies. That's my mum's voice. When I have to actually do an audiobook of this. Mum, that is how you're being committed to audiobook form. Keep them with their mummies and daddies. Oh, a lovely bowl of meat. That's an actual direct quote from my mum. Keep them with their mummies and daddies, Mum would say. And during observation, while temporarily housed in containers, they were handled with gentle, inquiring fingers. My brother was a dervish who'd climb pylons to retrieve footballs, a youthful vigour emanating from the adrenal gland. And this hyperactivity meant he struggled to conceal his thoughts, his interior monologue often leaking into social spaces. I want to have sex with my family. No, I don't, he'd blurt out, statement and retraction in one unbroken torrent. It might have been a mild form of Tourette's, if such a thing exists, but it was never diagnosed. He later became a rugby player who assessed people's value by scrutinising their appearance. And because of this, he once punched me in the face wearing a hat of dominoes. That tells you everything you need to know about our relationship. I was quiet, cerebral. I opted for the underground safety of a familiar garden or familiar bedroom or familiar mum or familiar Louis, who's my best friend. I was sensitive to vibrations, tumult, the mild tremble of discord, suddenly illuminated by another person's judgment. Like a worm. That was a worm. And worms have a bundle of nerve cells called a cerebral ganglia, which transmit exterior sensations. Everything is distilled down to its most rudimentary function. And whenever I attend silent prayer at the Quaker meeting house, or resist those addictive urges that'll blow up my life, or lie down on the kitchen floor because someone said I have a diagonal face, I strive towards wormhood, the way of the worm. Worms. Pathetic little worms. Someone said I had a diagonal face once. And they didn't expound on that in any way. They didn't say what they meant. But all of us in the room were kind of in agreement that I have kind of got a diagonal face. And I can't quite work out why. Because I've got some good facial symmetry, mate. I've got a jawline. I've got a good jawline. I hide it under this matted clump of hair on my face. But it's there. It's there, boy. Dad's a keen gardener, so it's always been an environment teeming with vibrant matter. Rebecca Mead, regarding a patient, a psychiatrist, Sue Stewart Smith, wrote, "Gardening provided Kay with a refuge and engagement with the world beyond herself. Also gave her confirmation of her capacity to provide care and tenderness in a less fraught context than that of her family relationships." I think it provided Dad with a haven away from work more than family, away from murderers caving in their partner's face in the radiator, that kind of shit. "I was inhibited by the potential for embarrassment, profound embarrassment in any social situation. So I plugged up my burrow. But within the cloistered world, in my house and my garden, watching moths with wings like arid land, enjoying, as Virginia Woolf wrote in her essay, The Death of the Moth, their meager opportunities to the full," an essay where she wouldn't stop calling the moth pathetic, "spittle bugs excreting foam from their abdomens, earwigs with a cerumen gloss. Amongst these tiny beads of pure life, I acquired the necessary qualities of any good carer, the capacity to provide care and tenderness, at least some of the time." At least some of the time. I mean, moving on to what I wanted to talk about, it's like relational interdependence. People exist in and through caring relations with others. That's what I believe. So rather than independence or dependence, which, you know, dependence can definitely form and become very toxic. I was in a codependent relationship, and I sort of lived a secret parallel existence free from the bondage of a difficult relationship, coming to life while she was at work. I once went and got some anal bleaching done just so I had something to do that day. And I feel for them because I had a fucking plait down there. It was like Rapunzel had crawled up my ass to die. I had this parallel life where I'd be high on opiates all day. I remember one afternoon I bought a load of advent calendars that were half price, because who's going to have an advent calendar in January? Chocolate doesn't keep. So I bought three cut price advent calendars and went into the park to sit by a war memorial and ate the chocolates one panel at a time. At the end of the calendar, it wasn't a countdown to Christmas. It was a countdown to her coming home from work, which put the fucking fear of God into me, because that was a very trying relationship. I was, to put it bluntly, a useless piece of shit in that. I was druggy, checked out. Um, two people who came into each other's orbit who shouldn't have, and then became inextricably fused, so that we were just waiting for someone to die so we could get out of there, slip out under the table. I was just waiting for that phone call where I learned that she'd been squished, so that I could thank the man who passed on that message. Like, thank God for that, mate. You think I've been... No, this has come as a real relief. This has really sorted me out, mate. This is really convenient for me. So, no, cheers, pal. You're free for a pint? You want to maybe celebrate your pint? No. Don't like pints. It is quite a substantial amount of fluid, isn't it, to drink? I mean, with a pint of milk, you kind of eat. You don't want to talk about milk. That's fine. You've got stuff to do. All right, mate. Speak to you soon. Laters. Back to the writing sample. This even applied to things without hearts or brains or ganglia, this capacity to provide care and tenderness. In Vibrant Matter, Political Ecology of Things, Jane Bennett writes that an idea which found expression in childhood experiences is that of a world populated by animate things rather than passive objects. The quarantines of matter and life encourage us to ignore the vitality of matter and the lively powers of material formation, such as the way omega-3 fatty acids can alter human moods, or the way our trash is not away in landfills but generating lively streams of chemicals and volatile winds of methane as you speak. Inert objects converse with me as if they possess their own agency, as if they were part of the human realm, like a bit of sweet corn I found under a hoarder's sofa, right? I was 4 years old and someone's nana told us about a faraway god, like a deity who faces away from his creation, looking out the window and ignoring all cosmic activity. So I applied god status to this sweet corn. And when I returned to that house 4 years later and looked under the sofa, the sweet corn was still there, the perennial sweet corn, ignorant of everything changing beyond its boundary. And the hoarder, who was 80 years old, had died by then. The house was taken over by his lodger, and the lodger had a pet something upstairs, and I still can't pinpoint what animal it was in my memory. It might have been a bush baby in a hutch in a council house in Ilford. I think it was a bush baby, had the eyes, but not the soul, not the soul of a bush baby in its natural habitat, which would be buoyant. And this one was wilting. It was very, very, very quiet. But then what sounds do bush babies make? I don't know. They're a nighttime animal. They probably don't want to wake people up. They don't want to wake up the neighbours, so they probably keep quiet. So talking about, oh, one sec, my battery's about to run out of my laptop. Right, pop this sucker in. Talking about interdependent relationships, and I want to replace individualistic notions of subjectivity. So Ayn Rand, like, in a belief system known as objectivism, she espoused the virtues of independence. And there's a quote where it says, one's acceptance of the responsibility of forming one's own judgments and of living by the work of one's own mind, which I think I actually do a lot. I'm in my own head a lot. I don't seek guidance from other people, but then I also do, you know, open up discussions and stuff. I love conversation. And the classic statement of this virtue appears in The Fountainhead, where Rourke contrasts the creator with the second-hander. Nothing is given to man on Earth. Everything he needs has to be produced. And here man faces his basic alternative. He can survive in only one of two ways. By the independent work of his own mind, or as a parasite fed by the minds of others. The creator originates, the parasite borrows. The creator faces nature alone, the parasite faces nature through an intermediary. The creator's concern is the conquest of nature. The parasite's concern is the conquest of man. The creator lives for his work. He needs no other men. His primary goal is within himself. The parasite lives secondhand. He needs others. Others become his prime motive. And this is quite apposite because we had a big debate on Twitter. So there's a Spectator article by, what's his name? That's going to annoy me. Let me just find his name. He's a famous comedian, a right-wing comedian. He's a self-identifying right-wing comedian. So I know some of people get forced into this category when it's actually against how they would define themselves. And I believe, you know, we should allow people to define themselves in a way that they want to be defined up to a point. Like, obviously, if you've got someone who's a killer, you can't really allow them to define themselves as a bush baby. Are bush babies predators? I mean, they try not to wake up the neighbors. I mean, I can't imagine they do. Killing is lively. Killing is a lively business. You're going to generate a certain amount of noise. So I don't really know how you can be a quiet killer. Simon Evans, that's the name of the comedian. And he wrote a thing in The Spectator. And a bit of it I sort of identified with, or I recognised. I wouldn't say it's 100% true, but I recognise his. He wrote, in fact, when it comes to professional instincts, comedy is a fundamentally right-wing exercise. It seeks no state support and rebuts any attempt at collectivisation. It has no five-year plan. It exists to say the unsayable, to demand license normally withheld by guardians, and indeed the guardian. Oh, well, right, Simon. And the stage is the least egalitarian place imaginable. Hierarchies emerge under the spotlights before the end of the first pint, and no comedian seeks to eradicate them. It's about as left-wing as a game of Russian roulette played in a brothel. Then that, I mean, that's a game of chance. That's pretty egalitarian. That's pretty left wing. I don't think, you know, Russian roulette. What's right wing about Russian roulette? And in a brothel, and acknowledging that sex work is work and should be unionized, which is something I believe in. That's a very liberal notion. That's a cause of the left wing, so that doesn't work. The truth is that the vast majority of comedians are apolitical, borderline sociopathic narcissists. Virtually all comedians start out as amoral chancers, sniffing around for a niche, like Ian's near namesake Arthur Dent. They play the percentages and look for a gap in the market. And I wrote a bit in my book where I said, I'm part of a comedy industry. Stand-up isn't an inherently collaborative form. Comedians are hyper-individualistic, entrepreneurial, and self-reliant. Almost fact-right in the way they operate, conforming to the Milton Friedman maxim that the world runs on individuals pursuing their separate interests. Whereas one comedian put it, ambitious comedians of the social media age will fuck you over for their own advancement at the expense of the common good, and they will discredit you personally to get ahead. Being one of those comedians with an eye on the arbitrary metrics of likes and views, and using those to determine your value, though not going so far as to fuck people over, it forces you to be mercenary and gladiatorial in an oversaturated industry. This is what you find when you enter a green room, side room, cupboard next to the boiler. I once did a gig perched on a buffet table, and they tried to deduct the price of the food I was offered from the fee. And I was like, you can't pay me in buffet. Look where I'm standing, boy. I am Buffet. There's a lot of chatter around this. And someone said, but the whole thing is just the Simon Evans article. The whole thing is just a hasty generalization about the innate apolitical nature of comics and how people don't like their views challenged. Obviously, not every comic is a commie or a Nazi, sure, but to write an article about an industry that rewards amoral opportunists and upholds consensus and has no infrastructure or state support without interrogating it, and then concluding that the biggest danger is left-wing hegemony, just comes across like batshit, both-sidery to me, and intentionally missing the point. And I sort of said he drew the wrong conclusions from his own argument, from his own point, but that doesn't mean that there's sections of the argument that don't ring true. And the same person who said, I think the point he's missed is that a lack of infrastructure, support, collectivism, and a wealth of opportunism, competition, and individualism are not discrete from each other, not a priori in the industry, not unique to comedy. Like, he's outlined what's wrong with comedy, then arrived at the conclusion that a non-existent leftist hegemony, I don't think that is non-existent, is what to look out for. I don't agree that comedy can be these things. I don't disagree that comedy can be these things. I just don't think it's so matter of fact, immutable, or comedy specific. So I have to think to take from the piece is that he's just recited a truism about work in general applied to our industry, then fine. But I don't think there's anything especially groundbreaking here, just a racist one-liner, a comedian getting paid to say, like you say, glib shit by transphobic paper. It wasn't groundbreaking, but I found myself agreeing with something in a publication that's usually trash. Then someone wrote in a more optimistic mindset. I think the scene is way more collectivist than it used to be, and it's mainly because of how society is changing. Younger people are more collectivist. The scene is more gender balanced. Rampant individualism has been rife in comedy only because it is rife among men over 28. The idea of the comedian who is out for individual success is less recognizable now. Most comics I know will help others, support and give advice to new comics freely for no personal gain. And that is true. A lot of comedians, established comedians that I know, have been very supportive and encouraging. The system does foster collectivism because ultimately lots of comics just want to hang out. I said, yeah, but even if there's no rational purpose for it, does that mean it doesn't exist? To be honest, I found some of the industry to be hospitable. I love it to pieces, but there's pockets of it that I find to be corrosive, cruel, and dysfunctional. And just on that, go on Twitter, follow Poppy Hillstead, and read her post about the treatment she got on a podcast which she helped to establish and has been an integral part of for three series called Gossip Mongers. And see how she's been treated in relation to that, and then tell me that there aren't self-interested mercenary comedians, unscrupulous some of them, but. There we go. That's been a bit of a long one today. I apologise. Thank you for hearing me out. See you next week. Thank you.